to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks. The Author's Tale is a series of casual conversations with prominent and influential New Zealand authors who have made their mark in New Zealand and overseas. They have often gone under the radar in their home country, but have contributed to New Zealand's cultural history in a way that if they were musicians, would be considered rock stars of their genre. They are the word stars of New Zealand literature. Not wanting to focus on a particular book or work, I'm more interested in speaking with the author in their own surroundings and getting an idea of where they have come from and what has influenced their journey to date. We meet where possible in their homes, not in a studio, so you may hear others moving around or pets coming to say hi. We drink coffee or tea and eat fruitcake made using my mother's recipe. She was the person who encouraged my love of a good book and great writing, so it seems fitting to include her. I'm Stephanie Fruin, and this is the second episode of my very casual chat with Christchurch-based award-winning writer of children's, young adult, short stories and flash fiction, Heather McQuillan. If you haven't listened to part one, I highly recommend you do. Last time we discussed her first novel, Mind Over Matter, and I wrongly stated that this time we would discuss her book, Avis and the Promise of Dragons. That will be in a future episode. Instead, coming up, we are discussing her second book, Nest of Lies, and all that was going on around it and subsequent to, and just how on the money she is with her reflection of the world.
Yeah, it was going to be two, and you've got a third. I think you need to get on and do that third one.
We can put some other projects aside. But it is there, yeah.
Brilliant. Now, so the next one in the lineup.
In the lineup was Nest of Lies.
What a complete contrast, yeah. Style-wise, yeah. To
yes.
This.
Yeah. Very much going for, it's adventure.
Yeah.
So, but it's dystopian.
Yeah, completely. Which I had to make this huge mental shift for that. You know, it took me a while to get my head, do you know how you know, sometimes mm-hmm. you do it? Because it was so different from that to this. And I guess in my head I was thinking, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, but it took me a while to get the mental shift going, but I got there eventually. Yep, it is definitely a mental shift. Tell me about Nest of Lies.
So this started with that idea that what if you've been brought up to believe a certain doctrine?
Yes.
And then you discover that
it's all lies,
the truth.
Yeah.
And you've been told that birds are evil. That scientists are evil, that all these things are bad, and then you come out and realise for yourself that they're not.
Yeah.
So that was the concept behind.
Yes.
There's a lot of research I did into this one around propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
So all of the aspects of propaganda are somewhere in the book and used and reflected here in the book. That then tied in with the idea of fairy stories. Don't ask me how or why.
Yeah, I noticed that.
But you will have noticed fairy stories. But it wasn't that I wanted to do a retelling of fairy stories. But it was how might this fairy story be told now? So when she comes across the little girl in the house.
Yep.
And there are three bowls of dried
up
porridge.
Exactly. You instantly go, Goldilocks.
Yeah, but she's not.
No.
It's not the Goldilocks story. There are no bears in there. She is called Ashley, is Cinderella.
And she's totally not like a Goldilocks.
Oh, no, well, Ashley is... No, the other little girl was the Goldilocks type girl. So she is called Ashley, which is Cinderella.
Right.
And she has the two horrible stepsisters. But... it doesn't play out that she goes to the ball and marries the prince at the wedding ceremony thing that she goes to.
Yeah.
She doesn't drop her slipper, she drops her wig. And she doesn't end up with the lovely, charming young man.
I found it quite disturbing.
It was, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did.
It's a lot that's disturbing in here.
Yeah, but I think probably because, you know, from a... from a female perspective, it's almost a little bit sort of a Handmaid's Tale-ish.
Yes, there was a bit of that.
You know,
It was around how women
are
expected to behave and be treated.
Yep.
So it is a patriarchal society absolutely. That she's in. And then when I realised and I rewrote this, remember rewriting it at the start, when I realised that the villain was her father.
Yeah.
He's the big bad wolf.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yes.
And that was quite hard for me to write, because my own father's not a villain.
Not a
lovely,
villain. Yeah.
Lovely, sweet, kind gentleman he was.
But so many do have villainous fathers.
Very villainous fathers, yes. So
don't
he
they?
Was the villain.
So I sort of, it's interesting when it comes to writing for children or young adults or youths, or however you'd describe this particular age group. It's interesting, isn't it, like where you draw the line of, is it going to be too hard for them to comprehend or not? But I think as a teacher, you are more aware of that children like honesty, and they can, you know, if you try and sugarcoat things, they know.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is why this one is aimed for the slightly older age group.
Yeah.
What's YA.
Yeah.
And young, youngish YA.
Yeah. And you can tell that, obviously. Yeah.
And there's death.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I don't know if you felt it, but when I wrote the scene, in which I won't name the character, but a wonderful character who I just loved, went into battle.
Yes.
And it's a in the air battle with a hot air balloon.
And not everybody survives the battle.
And not everyone survived the battle. And that day I wrote that scene, I was quite astonished, because I had no inkling that he was going to do what he did.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I cried as I wrote it.
Yeah.
And the next day I went back upstairs determined to go and rewrite that chapter.
Wow.
But it couldn't.
No.
Because that was what he wanted. It's what he would have done.
Yeah.
And he sacrificed to save the others.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's an astonishing thing, where your characters and your story goes in a direction that you as the author thought you had some control over, and you discover you don't.
No.
And that's, I think, part of that whole improvisation work that I had done, is you've got to take the risky path.
Yep. And go with what's brought to
you. Don't make it easy. And it's more interesting that
absolutely.
Way. And so then, of course, I have to have all the other characters deal with this death and yet carry on. And so
and you didn't, like I said, you didn't sugarcoat it. You don't.
No.
Exactly. Your characters took you somewhere that you weren't expecting to go, but you allowed them to do so. And the story takes care of itself. You know, the other characters will step in, they'll do what they need to do. You know, so but if you tried to step in the way, well, it wouldn't be.
No, and
it
I couldn't have him defeat what was going on and survive.
Yeah.
It just was going to be silly. It would have been unbelievable.
Exactly. And your audience aren't stupid. You know, they aren't stupid at all. So I've made some little marks here. What have I got here? Oh, so yes, and the thing about this one, about how environmental it was, very environmentally focused, which, of course, you know, we've been really aware of the whole climate change issue for years, you know, and was it Al Gore, wasn't it, with his, that was back in, gosh, was that the when did he come out with that? Was it the early 2000s or 1990s? He did his video about, you know, climate change. But in here you've got a lot about climate change, and there's a bit here, Mother Earth had joined in too. There we go, yeah. And I think yet again, it's so relevant for what's going on today. Mother Earth had joined in too, as if she was trying to shake off the parasites that crawled on her. Storms and earthquakes and tidal waves happened in rapid succession. Well, hello.
So this book is disaster.
Yeah.
Right? So
totally.
I do say
it is disaster.
It's disaster after disaster.
Yeah.
And it was written between, probably I was working on this 2007 to 2008 or so, or 9.
Yeah.
It was accepted for publication early 2010.
Right. And then, of course, we had our earthquake.
And then we had the earthquake. So what had happened, this is based in Christchurch in Akaroa around the peninsula.
Right,
And I had the cathedral tower topple, and I had the rocks fall down at Sumner, and I had east of Christchurch flood. And I actually went back and eased off.
Wow.
On some of that afterwards, because it felt too as because I was editing it after the 2011 earthquake, they actually rang me about 2 weeks once our phones were back on and said, are you okay? And we're like, yes, sure, but we have to go every day to find water and we haven't had the power on and so on. And we're living in this broken place. And then it was, now we need to start the editing. And it was like, oh, this... And so I softened some of those pieces as I went through. But then there's also been a pandemic. And Australia's on fire. So when I tell this to kids, they look at me and their jaws drop and their eyes... And they go, do you think this is my superpower, you know, as a writer? No, I did my research. If there was something, if there was going to be a disaster happen, it was going to be earthquake. But it wasn't the Alpine fault that we had. You know, this was worse. And the pandemic that they thought was spread by birds.
And I thought that was fascinating. Yeah, you just seem to hit a number of of, you know, future
events. I know, it's a bit scary, but it was, you know, pandemics come around every 100 years. Earthquakes are predicted and Australia's often on fire. So, you know.
Now's a perfect place to listen to a short piece from Heather's Nest of Lies. This is from early on in the book, Chapter 3. During the plague years, people who protected birds had been severely punished. Witches who had hidden a chicken or two for their eggs were hanged for all to see. The greeners who had chained themselves to the trees where birds roosted had shared their fate when the sprays came down. Houses had been torched when a canary cage, long forgotten, had been found empty but with the risk of harbouring disease. Despite knowing all this, Ashley said nothing to her stepmother or stepsisters about the nest. She did not want to share this secret. With the mysterious tube in her pocket, Ashley went about her work, showing on the outside that nothing was out of the ordinary. Once the dishes were finished and she had dampened down the fire, locked the doors and sprayed the bugs, Ashley remembered to let the hedge pigs out into the garden to feast for the night on the slugs and snails. She was fond of these little creatures and kissed each on its snuffling nose before placing them on guard duty around the garden. During the winter months when they curled up their bodies and hibernated deep in the dried grass and straw, she had missed this ritual, this contact with a living body. It was only when the rest of the household slept soundly that Ashley sat on her bed in the back room, lit her stub of candle and took the tube from her pocket. She unscrewed the lid and tipped out a roll of paper and a fragment of seashell like an oil puddle rainbow. Written on the paper were three words: secret, hope, Felix. Felix, she whispered the name, unspoken for so long. She recalled his hair, as black and shiny as hers, and his eyes, dark and thin-rimmed like their mother's. She remembered the sprinkle of speckles across his nose and the way he had smiled weakly at her through his pain as, for many months, Ashley had sat by his bed, telling him stories and holding his hand. Then one morning she had woken to find his bed empty and all of his things gone to the burning grounds. When her tears streamed and her body shook with sobs, she was told firmly to be a big girl. The only person who was willing to talk to her, to even mention Felix's name, had been her stepsister, Lila. Lila had pounced on Ashley's pain and picked at it like a scab. They didn't want him, she said. I heard them talking at night. He was so scrawny, like you, so it was the best thing to do, really, to have him taken away in a sack to the wilds. They wouldn't, Ashley had cried. Papa wouldn't. Oh, your father was sad about it. Lila's eyes glistened brightly as she spoke and she twirled her skirt as she skipped around Ashley. He cried, my son, the only precious thing left to me, my only son. But he did it all the same. He of all people couldn't have a discard in the family, now could he? Ashley wouldn't believe a word of this, not her father. Lila was a liar. Ashley looked at the note again. Felix was dead. His body had been turned to ashes, so who had written the message? It couldn't be Lila. She did not know how to read and write. This wasn't a trick of hers. It was someone who knew about the birds. Ashley picked up the shell. She turned it over and rubbed it between her fingers and held it to her nose. It was beautiful and strange to her, this thing from the sea. Secret. Hope. Felix, she whispered. I must keep the bird secret. Not hard. I talk to no one. I must have hope. Harder that. Felix. She rubbed the shell fragment on her bottom lip. Is not dead, and he is by the sea. And with that thought, she felt a flicker of hope.
So,
yeah,
you know,
that's exactly right.
But I liked playing with the idea of the refugees coming from Australia.
Yeah.
So that was also one of my little things that at that time of...
Who knows?
And still, way refugees were treated and have been treated on their boats. Yeah. So their boat comes into Lyttelton Harbour, and that's a rather gruesome bit that I wrote that, and I went, where does this come from my brain?
I mean, it certainly wasn't, it's not a bright and cheery book. Not at all.
I apologise. No.
No, don't apologise.
But we don't know
it.
What's in our brains, and these things come out.
No, and nor do we know what's around the next corner, do we? Look, something a little bit different as well about this book, which I really enjoyed, and I thought this was unique, because so many people, they have hints of it, but they don't take it to the extent that you did, and that was the accent for the character. And you wrote it. Tell us a little bit about
I almost regret that now.
Do you?
Yeah, it's because he has a mouth deformity.
Right. So the character's name is Ika?
Ika.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so he has a mouth deformity.
That hasn't been fixed. And I don't know, it was accepted at the time, but now it feels awkward to me and reading it out loud. And perhaps... I don't know whether I would change that or not.
Right.
Yeah, but it was hard.
Yeah, really hard to write.
And I'm not sure if it's hard to read. So it is something that when I've reread it, I've gone, oh, don't know that I'd do that now in that same way.
Interesting, isn't it? Because I had to get my head into the tune of it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And once I got into the tune, I was absolutely fine. And I didn't see it as a derogatory thing at all. What it did to me is it added depth to the character.
But he's lovely. He's so funny.
Yeah, and added real
bouncy.
Great, and added great depth to the character, and made him stand out as a unique person, obviously. But also, I think in today's world, everything is so standardised. You know, our language is standardised. If you don't speak English or derivative slightly of, then we're not interested in you. You know, all those sorts of things. Mm. And we're trying now. And this, I think now, there's a real climate of moving away from that, of being more accepting of different voice, different people, different whatever.
Yeah, and I think I would talk to some people about it if I was to do it again.
Yeah, exactly. And see whether you've got it sort of right, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I thought you did it really well, because it was really difficult, and it's not something a lot of people do.
No.
Do they? They just don't write
an
accent.
It was really hard to get that he couldn't make TH sounds and so on. Which is actually quite funny, because my father's was Cockney, and he couldn't do his TH sounds. He did Fs instead.
Yeah. Whiff.
40,000 feathers.
Yeah. 40,000 feathers.
Say that, Dad.
That's brilliant.
So he doesn't do his THs. But what I did love is he had this little saying, grandness. Oh, that's grandness, he'd say. Yeah. And so when I came back to do that beginning and ending, I start with once upon a time.
Yes.
But the next part of that sentence indicates it's in the future and it's da-da, right?
Yeah.
And then they finish with grandness. That's what we'll say, grandness ever
grandness.
After. Grandness ever after. So I was thrilled that I could use that in a lovely little playful way of...
Yeah.
The fairy story. Yeah. This is the fairy story.
Absolutely.
And it is gruesome in places. And I did get asked would I that when the seagulls peck the eyes out, of the sister, that was gratuitous, and I needed to remove that. And I actually stood against that, and I said, no, that is part of the gruesomeness of the original fairy stories.
Yeah,
that's in there. The birds peck out the sister's eyes.
Yes, that's been going on for a very long time in storytelling.
So that stayed. That did stay. I did fight for that one. Yeah. And I'm hoping it's not too gruesome.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you don't want to get too close to seagulls. I can tell you.
And I loved here, this is a bit here where, so it is all about questioning what you've been told and taught and, you know, learning for yourself about life and the world and things. And this is where you actually, mentioning that, when you mention that, you go, and it's also where you have the title in here.
Ah, yes.
So it says here, but I think I think quite the opposite. To clothe yourself in colours and finery that draw attention is immodest. That's why we all dress the same, to keep the attention on the mind, not the body. Is Minor, is that how I say the name?
Minor. Yeah, as in Minor Bird.
Minor Bird, yeah. Is Minor sat up and started to dress herself again? Ashley allowed herself to look up. On Minor's back, the water had dried and left tracks of salt glistening like crystals on a dark rock. It's all so strange, said Ashley, this questioning of everything I believe. And then...
Because that's a nudity. They're quite comfortable being nude.
Yeah. But necessary if you are to leave that nest of lies that you thought held you safe. And I thought, how lovely, what a great experience, that nest of lies.
That didn't come till after this had been accepted and we were almost at the publishing stage and it had a different title.
Yeah.
And I went for a walk on the beach because my editors up in Auckland were going, you know, we're just not so happy with the title. And I'm going, no, it's not right. And I went for a walk and I was just going, everything, what's the main ideas, what are the main ideas? And then I got the nest of lies because we've got the birds in there as well, still with the nest.
Yes.
And I raced home, I raced back, and we were actually staying at a batch up in Marlborough. I raced back and I wrote that bit into that scene. And to use that scene was still there, but the words nest of lies weren't. And put that in there and then said, here's the little passage. And that goes, they mentioned that on the back, as soon as you ask one question, that's when the unravelling begins and the nest falls apart. And what then? I come crashing to the ground? No, said Minor. That's when you learn to fly.
Yeah.
And I wrote that little piece in there as well, and that ended up. Yeah. In there. So that was a very last minute.
Wow. It's funny how these things come.
And that little addition. But that was, I was so thrilled when that just came. That was the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, titles are so hard.
Titles are so hard. But I just love that. I just thought that was, and it just summed up the book absolutely brilliantly.
Thank you for listening to The Author's Tale. I do hope you've enjoyed part two of Heather's story. You can find out more about Heather McQuillan at her website, heathermcquillanwriter.com. Join me next time for part three of Heather's Tale, where we talk flash fiction, how tricky it is, the difficulties of getting published in New Zealand, and her collection of flash fictions, Where Oceans Meet. The Author's Tale, presented and produced by me, Stephanie Fruin. You can contact The Author's Tale by email, theauthorstale@yahoo.com. This podcast has been brought to you by Edition Audiobooks, working with you to bring your book to life. EditionAudiobooks.com.